We have live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon. Good to have you both back.
Yeah.
Hello.
Good afternoon. We survived the snow apocalypse, et cetera, and actually the last couple weeks' news because we weren't on the air last week.
Yeah.
And a lot has happened in that period of time.
All right. Well, we won't be covering everything that happened in the last 2 weeks, but...
Sure, we will.
Well,
we got an hour.
We've got some surprises for you.
Yeah.
All right. Starting out with the passing of one of our better legislators.
Yeah. And this is something that did happen in the previous week, but I wanted to highlight it because it kind of got buried in the news. The passing of John Dingell, who holds the record for longest service in Congress, 59 years. He passed away about 10 days ago at age 92. And Dingell really was not a household name in most of the country, except for Detroit, which is where his district was. But he was instrumental in passing the Civil Rights Act, and Medicare, the Clean Water Act, and Obamacare. He had an enormous number of progressive legislative accomplishments to his credit in his tenure, and continued to be politically active as a commentator up through his death. So he will be missed, and he was of a breed that is not really very very common in Congress anymore. So a mantle that needs to be filled.
All right. Moving on, starting with local, and Michael Bryan finally publicly making his decision.
Yeah. Michael Bryan came out this week and said that he is not running for re-election for his city council, District 6. District 6 covers Ballard, Fremont, Greenlake, and Crown Hill. Those are neighborhoods with a lot of single-family housing in them. And those NIMBYs, those folks who didn't want a lot of the progressive politics that O'Brien represents to be a feature in their neighborhood, District 6 being perhaps the second most conservative district in the city behind District 7, which is downtown, Belltown, Queen Anne, and Magnolia, didn't seem to want Mike O'Brien to continue representing them.
I actually don't think that's true necessarily. I think that the anti-homeless contingent, particularly based in Magnolia and in Ballard, which is seen an enormous influx of large, ugly apartment buildings in the last 10 years or so, much denser than what people usually traditionally associate
and
with
Crown
Ballard.
Hill
and Crown Hill,
Green
yeah.
Lake and
yeah. But that contingent was very noisy and a relative minority, and was also buttressed by anti-homeless folks from around the city who were also targeting O'Brien and have really tried to make his life pretty miserable over the last 4 years. I think O'Brien felt really burned by the employee hours tax debate last year, which is certainly was true of the other three incumbents who have chosen not to run for re-election, who were on the other side of that debate. But they all had pretty negative experiences with the public feedback from the opposition to their respective positions.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be very interesting to see who steps up to run for O'Brien's seat. Kate Martin is probably the best known of the people who have already announced for that seat. And she ran for mayor in 2013 and has kind of gone off the deep end from her tenuous grasp on reality in that year. And has really staked out a very strong anti-homeless position in hope of capturing that contingent. It'll be very interesting to see if somebody progressive steps up to run for that seat and to carry on O'Brien's tradition, particularly his advocacy for environmental issues, which really is not represented on city council now, because that was something that Rob Johnson tried to be supportive of, and he's not running for re-election, and O'Brien is not running for re-election. So in terms of the environmental community, which not that many years ago was a real powerhouse in Seattle politics, with McGinn as mayor and O'Brien, who came in with McGinn and was seen as his ally on city council. It's going to be interesting to see if somebody picks up that mantle.
Yeah. Also, you know, he got hit hard by folks in his district for supporting the employee hours tax, but also for supporting an increase in services for the homeless and for relaxing encampment sweeps. He was one of the folks who came out against or came out critical of the mayor's deployment of the navigation team as her main form of response against to deal with the homelessness crisis in the city of Seattle. And that earned him a lot of criticism from residents in his district. As Job said, he was a proponent of a lot of environmental issues on the city council, from things like the plastic bag ban, which did away with free plastic grocery bags, to other waste reduction bills like the ban on plastic straws and styrofoam containers, and an effort to do away with unwanted phone book deliveries. But he was also a big advocate for bike lanes, which got him a lot of criticism in his district, too. There were a lot of folks who like being able to drive on streets that have fewer obstructions, like bike lanes and things like
and
traffic.
Bikes.
Yeah, and things like efforts to calm traffic on thoroughfares by reducing the number of automobile lanes, adding left turn lanes and bike lanes to some of the bigger thoroughfares in the city. That also earned him a lot of criticism. But he also instituted the Democracy Voucher Program, and Seattle residents will begin receiving their Democracy Vouchers if they haven't already received them.
Yeah, they were in the mail this week.
I got mine
That was passed by initiative. That was not a
yeah. Plan. But back in 2015, O'Brien supported the ballot initiative. Certainly he could have come out against it, and he didn't. He actually supported it, and that helped to really put it over the top in terms of getting voter support. He opposed the tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct along with Mayor McGinn, and he called it an expensive non-solution, and I think we're seeing that right now. There were other city council members at the time who were very gung-ho for it. He supported the $15 per hour minimum wage and other labor laws that have passed the city council, including the one that would allow Uber and Lyft drivers to unionize as soon as it's no longer tied up in court as it is right now. And he also supported easing homeless encampment sweeps and providing more money, particularly in the last budget cycle, for homeless services and for addressing affordable housing, another issue that people in his district were very passionate about.
He also got a lot of grief for the city's pilot program for homeless RV camping.
Yeah, and he was a big supporter
and
of that.
And given that a third of homeless people in King County are living out of their vehicles.
And almost half of homeless, or perhaps more than half of homeless people in the city of Seattle are living out of their cars or their RVs.
And the city really still has no credible program to try and address that need at all.
Yeah.
They've handled it very, very badly. And that pilot program was handled extremely badly and was also very expensive. So the criticism that was directed his way over that was really kind of unfair, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But because the pilot program was in his district, it was in Ballard,
he was
targeted for that as well.
Yeah. And in terms of bike lanes, too, he's been the major supporter behind building the missing link on the Burke-Gilman Trail, which abruptly ends in Ballard in order to and forces people onto heavily trafficked Ballard streets in competition with trucks and other industrial vehicles, because Ballard businesses that have dominated the waterfront there for decades don't want a bike lane to be built through their area. He's been a big supporter of building that missing link, and he's earned a lot of criticism from the Ballard business community for that. So I think he was just looking into that kind of headwind and saying, I don't want to have to run campaign with that against me.
Yeah, and bear in mind that with all of these incumbents who are choosing not to run for re-election, they were all originally elected citywide.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really seeing a shakeout for the district system, where incumbents are expected to represent their district and to prioritize the needs of their district. O'Brien was not originally elected to represent that part of the city. He was elected citywide. And he had the priorities of somebody who was elected citywide. And we're seeing this with a number of other people who have been elected and who are facing re-election this year as well. Shama Sawant in particular, as somebody who has earned a lot of criticism for not prioritizing the needs of her district. And we're seeing
fact, a lot of the stuff she has done has been to benefit people in the Central District.
Absolutely. And to benefit people who have needs that come before her, the committees that she's on
yes.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
So But that's really becoming the expectation now that district seats on city council prioritize representing their districts. And it's going to be an interesting test in terms of the elections this year of who wins those arguments, what types of candidates are chosen to represent particular
districts.
And
I think among the candidates that are running for re-election, the two most successful at that shift have been Lisa Herbold and Deborah Juarez, who was elected as a district representative. She's well known for winning projects for her district. But the others who are not running for re-election, not just Michael Bryan, but also Bruce Harrell and Rob Johnson and Sally Bagshaw, have had more of a citywide focus. Rob Johnson may be among that group, probably the most successful at working on district issues. And yet what he's won for his district has been mostly for the University of Washington and other business interests, and certainly not for just the average resident.
He's represented developers in his district very well.
Yeah, but he's represented developers citywide.
Yeah. And he was originally elected as a district rep, as was Lisa. And Lisa Herbold has done an exceptional job of constituent service.
O'Brien, Bagshaw, and Harrell, who came onto the council when it was before the districts were drawn up, have struggled with that issue, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Particularly Harrell, I think. Mm-hmm. And he's seeing the writing on the wall in terms of why he's not running for re-election.
He's struggled with doing much on the city council at all, I think.
Well, other than being an authoritarian jerk, but he came naturally. So
move on. All right, let's move on. Maria just mentioned navigation teams.
Yeah, the city auditor released a report. It's a regular report on the navigation team. It does quarterly reports as requested by Councilmember Lisa Herbold. It looked at four reporting checkpoints identified in earlier reports. First off was the city's ability to provide intervention for people who are newly homeless and to get them into housing before they become chronically homeless. There are two major setbacks that the city auditor's report has identified in meeting this goal. First, the navigation team mostly deals with the chronically homeless and not the newly homeless. And second, there's a lack of funding for resources that could get newly homeless folks off the street and back into housing right away. In other words, not enough affordable housing.
Yeah, and not enough affordable housing is, I would think, the major hurdle there. Yeah. And that's something well beyond the scope of navigation teams. You can't refer people to housing that doesn't exist.
Right. And the report says that the city needs to focus on other resources and outreach providers besides the navigation team to identify folks who are newly homeless and to get them rapidly rehoused. And the city needs to make an effort to communicate better with those other service providers. And it even lists those service providers in that report. And most of them are nonprofits that are not directly part of city projects. Number two on the list of four checkpoints is to make a priority of providing hygiene services to the homeless to avoid public health problems and to lower that barrier that a lot of homeless people have in terms of hygiene and their ability to get a new job or to get off of the streets into a housing situation. The report identified the problem as essentially that the city needs to increase the availability and operating hours for public restrooms and shower facilities and to keep them in good working condition once they are open and available, as well as to provide better consistent signage so that homeless people know where to go in order to find these facilities. That's a major issue that the city has not looked at in terms of this is an issue we need to tackle and we need to put some resources into it and actually do it.
And there has been resistance to that for a good 20 years.
Yes, there have, at least.
At least. I mean, I can remember proposals for a hygiene center downtown in the mid-90s that faced ferocious business opposition from Downtown Seattle Association, et cetera. And then Downtown Seattle Association produced this list. Well, gee, here are all these businesses that have restrooms. What's the problem? That doesn't really provide shower facilities, hygiene facilities, et cetera. And we're seeing—
And they're not open 24/7.
Exactly. And we're seeing now real public health problems associated with homeless encampments and with homeless people as disease vectors because they don't have the capacity to take care of themselves, not because they're not willing to, but because the resources aren't there and the facilities aren't there, or if they are there, they're not accessible for them to use when they're needed.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right, and that's exactly what the report said.
Yeah. In other words, homeless people have to poop too.
Yeah. Now, their points 3 and 4 are related to one another. Their first point number 3 is: has the mayor's office developed a plan for evaluating the navigation team's performance? And point number 4: and does this evaluation plan incorporate feedback from homeless and formerly homeless people? Now, the answer to both those questions is no. The auditor's report states that the mayor, the executive is how they refer to it, has handed that responsibility over to the Human Services Department and completely washed her hands of it and refuses to consider doing any independent evaluation of the effectiveness of the navigation team, even when that evaluation could be done at no cost or very low cost to the city. So the report has yet again pointed out that Mayor Durkin's reliance on the navigation team as her primary and in many cases her only major response is inadequate and inconsistent with the goal of reducing the number of homeless people on the streets of Seattle, that there are many other issues here where the city could be stepping forward and taking the lead and making a real impact, and it's simply not doing it because the mayor is funding this navigation team that just sweeps chronic homeless people around the city and does not much else.
And 2 points on that. Number one, that homeless providers are being held to a standard of accountability that is not being applied to the navigation teams at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those standards for accountability are tied to getting people into housing that doesn't exist. And that's tied to funding for a lot of the service providers. And that's been a real problem for emergency shelters in particular, which HSD has been trying to defund for the last couple of years.
Yeah, and
city council has stepped in to prevent that.
Yeah, and as you said, not only is the mayor holding these service providers to that evaluation, not doing any similar evaluation of the navigation team, not saying is the navigation team making an impact in terms of housing people. It's not.
And she doesn't
even want to look to see if it's making any impact.
And the second point I would make about that is that I know for a fact that a number of homeless providers have personally complained to me that they have tried endlessly to get homeless people to have meetings or to have substantive meetings with HSD and with Durkin's office, and they simply get ignored. Mm-hmm. That the opportunity to get input from homeless and formerly homeless people is there, but the city is simply not interested in hearing from them.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's tied to Councilmember Sawant's call for a review of the proposed HSD head.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
He's been one of the worst offenders for that.
Yeah, since the mayor has washed her hands of it and says it's now the Human Services Department's job to do this, the new Human Services Director, whoever that person is going to be, that's going to make a big difference in terms of how these issues are tackled. And so it's incumbent upon the mayor's office to allow the process to open up on that selection of a new Human Services Department director, because how else are we going to know that we will get someone in there who will actually tackle these issues and start coordinating communication between homeless service providers and getting the feedback of people who have experienced homelessness and can give the city good feedback on the effectiveness of its programs?
Yeah, because they're the experts. And, you know, Bruce Johnson, who is the interim director, has been one of the worst offenders. Mm-hmm. On that regard.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's also very frustrating because, you know, the money that's getting poured into the city's homelessness response is substantive, but a lot of it is getting wasted. It's getting wasted on the homelessness sleeps that Maria was just talking about, on a lot of other things that are not long-term solutions. They're cosmetic fixes,
yeah.
But they don't actually help the homeless. They're really counterproductive for the homeless. And they are not long-term solutions for the community either.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on. There was also a study out regarding minimum wage.
Yeah, this didn't get a lot of attention, but it came out about a week ago. A study on the increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour in the city of Seattle. One of the principal objections to that came from grocery and other businesses with relatively thin profit margins who were claiming that they would simply have to pass on their labor costs to consumers and try to whip up public opposition to a minimum wage increase in for that reason, that was not successful as an argument. And not surprisingly, because that kind of argument is frequently trotted out in opposition to minimum wage increases, a new study found out that that simply has not been true, that the minimum wage increase in Seattle has had zero impact on local grocery prices. That should be something to remember the next time a minimum wage increase comes before voters or comes before city council or county council. We've got a very slow stepped increase in to $15 an hour and beyond as it's indexed to inflation. And that really needs to be addressed because that was as of, 4 years ago now. And it's once again falling behind the cost of living in Seattle and particularly housing prices. It's very, very difficult for people on a minimum wage salary to live in the city of Seattle to be able to afford housing, let alone grocery prices or some other basic staples. But, you know, once again, the idea that putting money in people's hands is going to result in an increase in cost to consumers, it simply doesn't work that way. And we now have, you know, clear, hard data that shows that locally.
All right. And next up, Attorney General Bob Ferguson has a message for sheriffs.
Yeah, he warned county sheriffs this week to uphold the law. And what he meant by that is he meant Initiative 1639, which was passed back in November with nearly 60% of the voters approving it. That's the gun safety bill that set an age limit of 21 for purchase of semi-automatic rifles and requires background checks similar to the state's current law for handgun purchases. More than a dozen sheriffs and police chiefs in Washington state, particularly in rural counties, have said that they will not enforce the new law. Ferguson sent out a letter this week to those law enforcement officials warning them to enforce the law or face the consequences. They would be liable if someone who would have been prevented from getting a semi-automatic rifle under the law were to obtain one and then use it in a crime. He wrote, quote, "The taxpayers of your city or county assume the financial risk of your decision to impose your personal views over the law," end quote. He went on to point out that these sheriffs and police chiefs are enforcing the current law on background checks for handguns, so it makes no sense to not enforce this law, too. And logically, he's right about that, but logic is not what these white conservative cops are thinking about. What they care about is their racist fantasy of a, quote unquote, well-regulated militia. In other words, a group of white guys with semi-automatic weapons fighting off the hordes who are invading their county from south of the border. That's what they care about, and that's what he's up against.
And I should mention also that Ferguson is one of the many people who's expected to file a lawsuit in response to the national emergency declaration by the president yesterday.
All right. And sticking with Olympia, roundup of the bills.
A quick roundup of some of the bills in the state legislature in the past week. The Senate passed a bill on a 28-19 vote to repeal the state's death penalty law. The bill was sponsored by Reuben Carlisle of the 36th District in Seattle. This comes after the state Supreme Court ruled in October that the state's death penalty is unconstitutional. The death penalty law had been on hold since 2014 when Governor Jay Inslee imposed a moratorium on executions in Washington state shortly after he became governor. The state Supreme Court then this past year invalidated the law, so now this is a move to just remove it from the books. That bill will now go to the House for consideration.
I'm curious what the argument of those 19 no votes is,
given that
it's been declared unconstitutional.
I think
already.
It was primarily Republicans who were hoping against hope that it could be revived somehow. The House is now going to take that up and is expected to pass it, and of course Governor Inslee will sign it since he imposed the moratorium originally in 2014. Now, the Senate also passed this week Senate Bill 5258, which would require employers to provide employees who work in isolation to adopt a sexual harassment policy, provide mandatory training on sexual harassment, and provide a panic button for each employee who works in isolation. This is meant to protect low-wage workers like hotel housekeepers, office janitors, and security guards who often work alone and are vulnerable to abuse. And attack. That bill will now move to the House for consideration and is expected to pass there. The House passed.
And that's very similar to a local initiative that was passed in Seattle a couple
years
ago.
Yeah, very similar to that. House Bill 1638 passed the House Health Care and Wellness Committee. That bill would ban the personal or philosophical exemption for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine for school-aged children. All nine Democrats on that committee voted in favor of it, and just one Republican supported it. That was Representative Paul Harris of the 32nd District in Vancouver, which is in Clark County, which is the epicenter of the current measles epidemic in Washington state. That bill now goes to the House Rules Committee, where Harris also sits, and he will also support it there. And so it has a good chance of passing on to the floor of the House, where it will likely pass and then be referred to the Senate. But there's a second vaccine bill making its way through the Senate. That's Senate Bill 5841, which would end the personal or philosophical exemptions for all vaccines required for school attendance. That's in the Senate Health and Long-Term Care Committee. And it doesn't look like it's moving quite yet, but it may move to eventually to the Senate floor. Now, there are 34 separate bills that deal with housing and homeless issues that have been introduced by Democrats in the House. The ones that are receiving the most attention include House Bill 1406 to allow counties and municipalities to impose a sales tax for affordable housing, which would be credited against the state sales tax, not added on top of it. House Bill 1921, which would change the real estate excise tax from a flat rate to a graduated rate and invest some of the revenue in the Housing Trust Fund to build affordable housing. And then several bills that seek to reform the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, including different proposals to increase tenant protections, like increasing the grace period for a tenant to pay overdue rent before they can be evicted. And currently, that's only 3 days.
Yeah, and tenant laws in Washington state are among the weakest in the country.
Yeah. Now, the proposals being discussed in the House range from increasing that grace period from 5 days in a Republican bill to 21 days, one of the Democratic bills. It's likely that any change that's made will be somewhere in between those two proposals. These bills were all sponsored by Representative Nicole Macri of the 43rd District here in Seattle. Yeah. In addition to her work in the state legislature, she also serves as the deputy director for strategy at the Downtown Emergency Services Center, which provides services to homeless and low-income people in Seattle. And it's really her mission this year in the state legislature to get some of those bills passed. And yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on those.
And she, since her election in that district, has been much more progressive and much more reflective of the needs of that district than the other representative there, which is Frank Chop.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So,
is that it?
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Moving on. Needless to say, for any of those bills, now is an excellent time to contact your state legislature and let them know what you think.
Yeah. And before we move on to national, we'd just like to say that you are listening to Eat the Airwaves on KODX 96.9 Low Power FM in Seattle. If you like 96.9, yes, if you like our programming and you want to support the station, we are all volunteer, and we would love your financial support.
Throw us some money. Yeah.
Yes.
Because it does cost money for the electricity and to run these programs. And as Maria said, it's an all-volunteer station, and we're just getting off the ground, and we need your financial support. So go to kodxseattle.org, and there is a donation button there, and make use of it. And tell your friends as well, because.
And what's the address, Mike, for people who want to mail us a check?
Well, they will forget shortly after it passes my lips, but it's P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145.
And again, that's also at the website, which is kodxseattle.org.
And we'll repeat that at the end, too.
And we have a Patreon button right in the top right corner. You can also just directly go to Patreon and just do patreon.com/KODX.
So, or if you see Maria or I on the streets, you can just hand us some money. We'll do that, too.
Drop off the bag in the usual spot.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on then to our dearly beloved local corporation that we all have major stock in, Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon had a major change of plans this week. Their much touted second headquarters that was split between the Washington, D.C. area and Long Island City in Queens in New York City had a change of plans. They backed out of New York City for a number of reasons, but primary to it was the amount of community activism in opposition to their move to to Queens. And that opposition was largely fueled by the Seattle experience. In fact, City Council members Lisa Herbold and Teresa Mosqueda flew out to New York City a couple of weeks ago to meet with community activists and explain exactly what had happened as a result of Amazon's growth to things like affordable housing, workforce jobs, et cetera, in the Seattle area. And community activists there used that information in opposition to Amazon's move to New York City.
Yeah, and they partnered with local unions to really question some of Amazon's business practices as yeah. well as the impact of Amazon here in Seattle.
Yeah, and I think what happened there, and we haven't gotten a lot of really honest coverage of this, is that Amazon looked at this, and as Maria said, activists were questioning not just the local impact, but Amazon's overall global business practices, how they treat their workforces, you know, around the world. And Amazon made the calculation that in the largest media center in the United States, they really didn't want that kind of ongoing attention because that kind of opposition was not going to go away no matter what they did to offer concessions to the local government there. So they decided to back out. And that represents a tremendous victory for community activists. And it is a reminder that community opposition to various actions by Amazon in Seattle can be successful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my quote of the week is from New York City Council member Jimmy Van Bramer of Queens, who said of Amazon, quote, "They want to crush unions. They want to work with ICE. They want to bypass community review. They want to take giant subsidies. I don't see them changing one bit. And so, yeah, they're not welcome here," end quote. That's my quote of the week.
That's an awesome quote.
Yeah, it's an awesome quote. And everything that he mentioned there has really been an issue with Amazon, the fact that they will not allow unionization of their workplace and that they are working on facial recognition technology to provide to ICE for immigration raids and so forth. As part of their deal with the state and the city of New York for $3 billion in incentives and tax breaks, they did specify that their construction projects would bypass all community review. Taking giant subsidies, yes. In fact, this year, not only did they not pay one penny of federal income tax for 2018, they will receive a rebate of $129 million in tax from the federal government in 2018, a year when they have booked $11 billion in profit as a profitable corporation.
That's B as in billion dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, well, we pay state and local taxes. Well, yes,
when they can't possibly avoid it.
Their state and local tax bill over the last two years was $267 million, which is a tax rate of about 2% of their profits for the two-year period. That's all the tax that they've paid. So it's worth asking. Not only should localities question Amazon's business practices, but shouldn't they be asking Amazon to pay in order to come into these communities? Because they have not been paying their fair share up to now.
And they certainly haven't been paying to help cover the cost of the impact of the needs the community realizes as a result of their presence. So there's that, and then there's the who do you root against spectacle of Jeff Bezos versus the National Enquirer, which has been very interesting in that apparently...
Kind of like watching two crabs fighting on the bottom of the sea. You want them to take each other out.
But it's been interesting because the security folks that Bezos hired to try and find out what National Enquirer's source was for the salacious... texts that Bezos sent to his mistress, it turns out to have been the mistress's brother, who is a friend of Carter Page and Roger Stone. And there was an implication in the security report that Bezos cited that the brother didn't get this by, you know, stealing his sister's phone or anything, that his source for these pictures was a quote-unquote government source, which, questions here about the National Enquirer's links to Saudi Arabia, the Trump administration, of course, all kinds of dubious questions. And it also brings up the question of the AMI's settlement with the Mueller investigation, where the Roger Pecker, I believe is his name, is the CEO. He is a cooperating witness in that probe now. And the non-prosecution agreement that he signed in order to become a cooperating witness specifies that AMI will not break any law. And so the question is, in the handling of the Bezos texts, is the extortion that Bezos is alleging, is there violations of law there? And does that break the non-prosecution agreement around the Mueller investigation? So this is actually tied to quite a bit deeper waters than just Jeff Bezos's salacious marriage issues. But it's definitely the two crabs fighting scenario. So there was a ton of different scandal developments over the past couple of weeks. Why don't we talk first about the national state of emergency? That kabuki has been unfolding over the last 24 hours and will continue to unfold over the next few days, I think. There are going to be a number of lawsuits challenging that, both from Congress, from different states. California has already said they're going to file a lawsuit. Bob Ferguson has indicated he might file a lawsuit. The city of El Paso on the border. So local jurisdictions as well as Congress and different individual senators who have jurisdiction over appropriation
House
of money.
House Democrats have said that they would file a lawsuit.
Yeah.
So the court challenges are going to be many and varied for this. Now, the border deal that was struck, what the Democrats called a border deal.
Which is why we don't have a government shutdown this morning.
Yeah. Includes $1.375 billion for 55 miles of new fencing along the border. Hardly a win for Democrats, although it is less money than Congress offered Trump last June, which he turned down, and then later turned down another similar deal in order to shut down the government.
And it also specifies that they can't spend that money in a number of specific areas, mostly the most populated areas along the border and the areas that currently have fencing. When Trump talks about extending the current fencing, that's not going to happen with this legislation.
Yeah. So in that sense, you know, Trump didn't just lose his fight for the wall. He actually threw away a better deal that was offered him
a couple of times previously.
Yeah, a couple times in the previous year. So that's really not easy to do. It's actually kind of hard to do. And he's become a master at not just bad negotiations, but outright terrible deals. And that's what he's got here. And when he declared his state of emergency, what he didn't tell you is that his advisors and his legal experts had identified that he could have, without declaring the state of emergency, directed some money for the initial construction of his quote unquote Great Wall. The fact that they determined that he had to declare a state of emergency to get all of the money he wanted is an outright admission that it's going to cost way more than he has said, in the realm somewhere of not just $5 billion, but somewhere between $20 to $70 billion to build the darn thing.
And he said very specifically in his news conference yesterday, which this will be cited in a number of the lawsuits, that number one, he didn't need to do this, but he was doing it because he could get the money faster this way.
Yeah.
That's not a state of emergency.
That's not an emergency, no.
And it is taking over the right of Congress to appropriate money, which is
unconstitutional. Yeah,
it's like the first thing in the Constitution, right? Congress appropriates money.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to have tough sledding in the courts.
But in addition, his emergency declaration, the money that he initially identified that he wanted, about $8 billion, not the $5 billion that he asked for, $8 billion, which again means it's not an emergency. It's really just a way to steal money. He's taking $3.6 billion from military construction projects, which is not earning him a lot of friends in Congress, particularly for those congressmen who represent districts that are going to lose out on that construction money.
Including in Missouri and North Carolina, Republican lawmakers
for those districts are
pretty aghast at this.
And he's also taking $2.5 billion from counter-narcotics measures and programs. And that's,
wait a minute.
Yeah, that's like saying, okay, we're building this wall because we want to prevent drugs from coming into the country. But oh, by the way, we're going to take money from counter-narcotics to do that. You're taking money from a program that works and throwing it down a black hole that is not going to work because the vast majority, and these are statistics from his own Department of Homeland Security and FBI and DEA,
which he poo-pooed yesterday.
Yeah,
by the way.
say that between 80 to 90% of the illegal narcotics that come across the border come through ports of entry, do not come through places that don't have a wall or a fence or border patrol
patrolling them. And reporters confronted him with those statistics yesterday, and he said flat out, "I don't care about statistics." Yeah. from his own government.
Yeah.
Which I mean, that whole performance yesterday was it's easy to forget because we've been so numb to it over the past couple of years. Just how horrifying it is that this man is actually the most powerful man in the world. But we had a good demonstration.
And apparently cannot, for the life of him, tell the truth on anything.
And he can't tell what's truth and what's not.
And in addition to the $3.6 billion from military construction and $2.5 billion from counter-narcotics programs, they're gonna divert $600,000 from the Treasury for important programs that the Treasury would be running. So that there you have Donald Trump declaring
a
state of emergency wants money to build a vanity project that will not make a difference in terms of immigration.
And again, those programs are all programs that Congress approved. And so that's going to be a tough legal burden to
overcome. him to fund a program that Congress specifically said it did not want to fund. And that is where you get into the unconstitutionality of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to run through some of the other scandal developments over the past week and a half, because there's literally something every day. So I just want to highlight some things that people may have missed. A lot of stuff going on around the Southern District of New York subpoenaing the Trump inauguration slush fund. And Google Thomas Barrack, a good long-term friend of Trump, who was in charge of the inauguration and has all kinds of ties to Saudi Arabia. That's where he made his oil money. He is, of course, another billionaire. So, that's going to be very interesting to see what comes of that. Paul Manafort looks like he's going to be in jail for the rest of his life. The Mueller had a court filing yesterday agreeing with the government guidelines for sentencing, which will be somewhere between 19 and 24 years and up to $28 million restitutions and fines. He's going to be having, and Judge Amy Jackson ruled that Manafort had lied to Mueller and breached his cooperation deal with the feds, particularly.
And not just lies of omission. She pointed out that that what he did was he actually fabricated stories to try to draw prosecutors away from the truth, which is outright and egregious lying.
Yes, and intentional and egregious, and lied over a long period of time as well. And in particular, regarding a August 2nd, 2016 meeting during the height of the campaign with Manafort, his deputy, Robert Gates, who's now a cooperating witness, and the Russian agent and Manafort business partner known as Konstantin Kolimnik at a Havana Club cigar bar in Manhattan, where they all left by separate entrances to try and evade detection. That was the meeting at which Manafort apparently gave a Russian intelligence agent detailed internal polling from the Trump campaign, which was apparently then used to micro-target the social media campaign that the Russians used to try
presumably.
And influence the election, presumably. And so that, in the words of the court filing, went to the heart of what the Mueller investigation is investigating. So Mueller's in a lot of trouble for that. We had
Manafort is. Yeah.
Yes. We also had Paul Erickson, the lover of Maria Butina, the Russian agent who has pleaded guilty to spying on behalf of Russia with the NRA and other gun fetishists. Paul Erickson, a Republican activist who is was Butina's boyfriend, was also charged as acting as an agent on behalf of Russia. That came out about 10 days ago. The Trump reelection campaign has paid up to $100,000 of Jared Kushner's legal fees. So when you buy that MAGA hat, that's what you're buying, is Jared Kushner's legal fees, because God knows he can't afford them himself. And so we had that going on. The White House leak, of course, that Trump's executive time schedule with about a 6 hour a day job. And then we found out yesterday, just last night, number one in a court filing that Roger Stone, that the Mueller investigation has detailed emails between Stone and Guccifer 2.0 and identified individual Russian agents regarding the timing of release of stolen DNC emails during the 2016 campaign. That right there is your collusion. What this is all adding up to basically is a massive conspiracy that is likely to be prosecuted, I would think, under RICO statutes. That exactly is what Trump has been operating. It's a mob-style operation. That's what the RICO statutes were designed to combat, and that's the most appropriate prosecutorial tool for this kind of very extensive, very detailed conspiracy, where there are a number of different arms and a number of different contact points between the Russian government and the Trump campaign and the Trump transition team and the Trump presidency. And we've seen any number of examples since then of Donald Trump being obsequious toward Vladimir Putin and taking Putin's word for it over the word of his own experts. And we saw a couple of revelations of that again in this past couple of weeks. It just goes on and on and on. So, and we also saw, incidentally, the defunding of the ethics office in the executive branch that the Trump administration clearly did not want to hear from because the Trump administration is a walking breach of ethics guidelines. So a lot going on with the Trump administration, and none of it's good from a legal standpoint.
No.
So let's talk about other bills in Congress.
Yeah, other bills that passed in Congress this week. First off, the land conservation bill. On Tuesday, the Senate voted by a vote of 92-8 to pass a bipartisan bill that sets aside 1.3 million acres of land for new wilderness areas, which extends the strongest environmental protections to that land. Among the areas protected are lands in Utah, New Mexico, Oregon, and California. The bill also protects over 600 miles of river, protects 300,000 acres from mining, and creates four new national monuments. In Washington state, the bill would protect the headwaters of the Methow River from mining. It would protect 340,000 acres in the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest from development. It provides funding to expand the volcano monitoring system in Washington state, provides funds for drones and GPS systems for fighting wildfires, and looks at other technology that could be used for fighting wildfires.
I thought as long as you raked the forest, you'd be okay.
No. And it designates the Nordic Heritage Museum in Seattle as the National Nordic Heritage Museum, which I would think would qualify it for some national funding. And it would provide funding for water projects in the Yakima Basin to balance water flows for both agricultural and environmental purposes. This has been a kind of controversial project because part of the project would pump water out of the Catches Lake in the Cascades to feed irrigation flows in the Yakima Valley during dry years. But politically, there's been a lot of push for it here in Washington state. And Maria Cantwell, who was the co-sponsor of the bill, she definitely wanted that in there. So it got in there. The bill doesn't just protect lands in the West, though. For example, new rivers protected under this bill include the Wood Pocketuck Rivers in Rhode Island and Connecticut, the Farmington River and Salmon Brook in Connecticut, and the Nashua, Squanicook, and Nissatisset Rivers in Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Well pronounced.
Thank you. The bill also permanently reauthorizes the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and this was very important because that fund supports more than 42,000 state and local land conservation projects across the United States in all 50 states and is funded with federal money collected from offshore oil and gas leases. That fund has provided some $600 million to Washington state for land conservation since it was established in 1964. Congress originally authorized that fund as a short-term program, but has renewed the fund on a regular basis ever since because it's been so popular. But the program expired on September 30th of last year when Congress failed to pass a full budget bill to keep the federal government open. This bill would prevent that from happening again by fully funding and continuing that fund in perpetuity.
And I want to mention that a number of the projects that this bill funds were things that under Ryan Zimke, the Interior Department, had tried to slate for resource extraction.
Uh-huh.
So it's protecting some of those lands.
And the Trump administration had tried to cut 95% of the funding to the Land and Water Conservation Fund in its last budget proposal, but Congress overruled that during the budget negotiations because that's such a popular fund.
And just in the last couple of weeks, we saw the EPA spiking the State Department of Ecology on Snake River Dam removal. So there's still a lot of concerns about what the Trump administration is doing.
Yeah.
And that really falls to Congress to prevent.
I think in that case, the EPA was actually spiking the state ecology's, the Washington State Department of Ecology's ability to regulate water flows over dams. I don't think it actually had to do with dam removal.
Okay. But still, serious.
Still, it's the Trump administration trying to say, you know, and these guys, as conservative Republicans, are supposed to be supporting states' rights, right? But they're using the federal government as a cudgel to say, no, you states can't regulate your own environmental concerns. The federal government wants to deregulate. We as the federal government, the Trump administration, we want to deregulate environmental regulations. We want to do away with them. And we don't want the states to step in and regulate their own environments, which is ridiculous. Yeah.
All right. But there was other bills, too, that they.
Yeah. The House of Representatives exercised the War Powers Act this week and voted 200.
Wow.
Yeah, and voted a very rare exercise of the War Powers Act. They voted 248
to really dust that one off.
Yeah, to 177 to end U.S. military aid to Saudi Arabia for its aerial bombing campaign of Yemen. 80,000 people have died from the fighting in Yemen since 2015.
That is the single biggest humanitarian crisis in the world right now.
70% of the nation's population in Yemen is undergoing famine, with 250,000 people at risk of starvation this year. 18 far-right isolationist Republicans voted along with the Democrats to support that bill. The Democrats are calling on the Senate now to hold a vote this year. Last year, in the wake of the Saudi assassination of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the Senate voted to end military aid to Saudi Arabia, but the bill never came up for vote in the Republican-dominated House. If the Senate chooses this year to also exercise the War Powers Act and vote on this bill, then Donald Trump might be forced to issue the first veto of his presidency in support of a chaotic, despotic Middle Eastern government like Saudi Arabia.
That'd be a surprise.
The War Powers Act was passed by Congress in 1973 in the wake of the Vietnam War. It says that the president can unilaterally declare war only if the U.S. has been attacked. It also allows Congress to vote to immediately end troop deployments. So in this case, it was the House exercised the War Powers Act in order to prevent the president from continuing to support a war in which the U.S. has not been attacked, and to immediately end aid to Saudi Arabia in its aggression against its southern neighbor.
All right. Anything else?
Yes, there were some gun safety bills that passed on the one-year anniversary of the Parkland, Florida high school shooting that killed 17 students and staff.
And, of course, we had another mass shooting yesterday.
At Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, yeah.
Aurora, Illinois.
Aurora, Illinois.
Not Aurora, Colorado. That was a few years ago.
This was not a school shooting, though.
No.
But I believe it was a warehouse.
Yes, it was a manufacturing plant, and it turns out the shooter had a conviction in 1994, I believe, of stabbing a woman. So the question
should have prevented him from having
lethal
weapons.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the House Judiciary Committee this week voted and passed a bill on Wednesday to require background checks for all gun sales everywhere in the United States and for most gun transfers. That bill passed on a vote of 21-14 and will now go to the floor of the House for debate. At least 5 Republicans on the committee voted for that bill.
And that is the first time a gun safety bill has gotten out of committee in Congress, literally in decades.
Since 2007, these gun safety bills, it's the first time that any gun safety bill has gotten a hearing in Congress or in the House since 2007. That's well over a decade.
Yeah. I think it's been the 70s since anything actually passed the House.
Yeah. Now, a second gun safety bill also was passed by the committee, one that would close the loophole in the current background check law that lets gun purchasers automatically take possession possession of a new firearm if their background check isn't completed within 3 days. In this case, the vote for that was 23-15, with a number of Republicans joining to vote for that bill. A third bill was introduced this week in both the House and Senate to ban high-capacity magazines that hold more than 10 rounds of ammunition. In the Senate, the bill had 31 co-sponsors, all of them Democrats. So it's a question whether or not it would pass the Senate, although it looks like it will pass the House. All three bills, of course, are likely to pass the House, but not necessarily likely to pass the Senate unless Democrats can get a few moderate Republicans to support them. And we'll see how that goes.
All right. Starting to get tight on time, and we want to make sure we mention events.
I just want to mention briefly the Supreme Court. You can skip to that.
Yeah, let's skip to that.
The Supreme Court agreed to bypass the normal appellate process and hear the lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's inclusion of citizenship status on the 2020 census. This is being challenged on the basis that of a lot of expert testimony that it would discourage not only undocumented immigrants, but also citizens from filling out that portion of the census and being counted. And of course, the purpose of this, which is to deny Democrats representation in Congress, since the 2020 census will be used for the 10 years after that to determine congressional representation. So that is going to go directly to the Supreme Court, since the Census Bureau needs to have an answer on that to start printing the census forms this coming June for the census a year from April. So that will be a key ruling coming up in June by the Supreme Court.
Okay. Also, briefly, hit the $22 trillion mark on the national debt.
Yeah, which it was $20 trillion only a couple of years ago, but thank the Trump tax cuts for that.
To add an additional $2 trillion to the debt. This is after the Trump administration claimed, and all their supporters in Congress, all the Republicans that supported the tax cut, claimed that cutting taxes would actually reduce the deficit.
And it'll pay for itself.
Yeah, and that has not been the case and is not going to be the case.
Yeah, trickle economics does not work. Who would have imagined?
Yeah, and see, we have lots of examples from the past.
Yeah, there's all kinds of data.
Yeah, look at all the data from the last 100 years of tax cuts, and you'll see that tax cuts never pay for themselves in terms of the federal deficit.
Well, and they were also talking about all the jobs it was going to create, because all these rich folk were going to hire more people when they got the tax cuts. And we continue to see stories coming out almost on a daily basis that just is not the case. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah. Who would have imagined?
I know.
Okay. Events.
Events. What's coming up?
Well, last week, the memorial for Rick Anderson, who we talked about a few weeks ago, passed away, a longtime Seattle journalist, that was snowed out. So the memorial has been postponed to Sunday, March 3rd. That is a week from Sunday, I believe. No, 2 weeks from tomorrow. That'll be at the Victory Lounge, 433 Eastlake Avenue East, between Harrison and Republican in Southlake Union. And I will mention that again once we get closer to the date. Coming up this week on Thursday, the 21st of February, mandatory housing affordability citywide public hearing. That will be a Seattle City Hall Council Chambers, a hearing on mandatory housing affordability. Fifth and James, downtown
Perhaps
Seattle.
The only hearing where people can go and really tell the city council what you think of the new upzoning laws.
Yes, there's been a series of them. This is the last of them, I believe. So
this
will be your last chance. And then also that same evening, Thursday the 21st, Oceana Rising, Peace Pivot to the Pacific. It's a tour with speakers from Okinawa, Guam, and Hawaii talking about the intersection between climate change and militarism. That's hosted by Veterans for Peace Local 92. It'll be held at El Centro de la Raza on Beacon Hill at 2524 16th Avenue South, within easy walking distance of the Beacon Hill Light Rail Station. So go and check that out if you can't get into City Hall because it's too crowded.
Yeah.
So those are happening at the same time. That's between 7 and 9 on next Thursday evening.
Okay, and I just want to remind folks that if you enjoy what you're hearing, you're listening to KODX 96.9 Low Power FM, and this is Eat the Airwaves. We are all volunteer, and if you would like to support us by making a financial contribution, you can go to our website, www.kodxseattle.org, and click the Patreon button or send us a check. And what is that address, Mike?
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And you'd want to make that out to Earth on the Air Independent Media.
Yeah. And also check out KODXFM.org because the schedule has a lot of great news and public affairs programming. That is what we do here is news and public affairs. So if you want...
KODXSeattle.org.
Yep.
All right. And you had said if you enjoy what you hear here.
And I don't traditionally... if you appreciate what you hear here.
That's what I think we should focus on. All right. So...
Some of us enjoy getting the straight truth.
That's true. I know there's, I just want to include more people.
It can be a great relief after listening to a lot of mainstream media to finally stumble across somebody who's saying, giving me facts, telling me what the issues are and talking about it in
context. Yeah.
Yeah. Putting it in context and talking about it in depth. That is an enjoyable thing.
Valuable thing.
Yes.
And we'll be talking to you again next week.
Yep. Same time, same station.